I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, in honor of Giving Tuesday, we're going to talk about the changing face and nature of philanthropy. We will discuss what prompts people to share their time, talents, and resources with causes that matter to them, and how the ways they do so may have shifted over time. My guests are our own Pam Elliott from WFYI, and Dr. Una Osili and Dr. Sarah Conrath, both of Indiana University's Lilly School of Philanthropy. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about philanthropy, how giving has changed. Today, of course, is Giving Tuesday. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Dr. Una Osili. She is professor of economics and director of research at IU's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Dr. Sarah Conrath, she's associate professor at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And our own Pam Elliott, who is director of on-air development for WFYI. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
And happy Giving Tuesday. So I'm going to start basic, and I will apologize in advance to the listeners whose intelligence I may be offending here, but I think it's best to start by understanding the terms. I want to talk about, how we define philanthropy. And I'm going to throw that one first to Una, but anyone who wants to chime in may do so.
Thanks so much. That's a great starting question. Philanthropy is a core American value. It embodies the gifts of talent, time, and treasure, so money and time. And we use a definition that is probably maybe a broad definition, but it's private action for the public good. Anytime any individual reaches out to a neighbor to help, whether that's formally or informally, they're expressing a philanthropic spirit. So private action for the public good. That's giving money, it's giving time, it's giving talent. And so with that broad definition, one thing that we say frequently at the Lilly Family School is that it doesn't take large sums of money to be a philanthropist. At all levels of income, of education, we see that Americans give at very high rates. About two-thirds of Americans give in any given year. And more than $370 billion is given to charitable institutions in this country, which suggests that philanthropy is deeply embedded in American institutions across this country, across race, ethnicity, and income levels, there's a strong commitment to giving.
$370 billion is not exactly a small sum. Do we know where that money goes?
We do. Through our work with the Giving USA Foundation, every year the school releases Giving USA. And this year, our latest data shows that about a third of all American philanthropy goes to houses of worship. And so that is still the largest destination of our charitable dollars. But after that, education, the education sector that is colleges and universities, K through 12, is the second largest recipient. And then we have included human services, arts and culture, as well as the environment, international causes, and many, many other nonprofits. As many of you on the listening side know, we have more than 1.4, 1.5 million charities in the U.S., nonprofits that serve diverse needs in Indianapolis, but also in communities around this country.
Sarah, I'm going to toss this because I know your area of expertise is really in sort of the changing nature of philanthropy. Have we seen, I know it was an article of faith a few years ago when I was the leader of a not-for-profit, that we had to get ahead of where this was going, that millennials were showing different giving patterns, and that really the baby boomer generation, that old, the model that worked for them, was no longer as effective. was that a fact or is it more a myth?
Well, my research, I'm a social psychologist, so I study why people give and traits mm-hmm. related to giving, like empathy. And I've tracked generational changes in empathy and also narcissism, which is like the opposite, being self-focused and not caring for others. And what we found is that the millennial generation, and I have to be careful here not to stereotype, but on average, mm-hmm. millennial generation is showing lower empathy compared to generations before them and higher narcissism. And that's based on their own self-reports.
How do you define? I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
that's okay.
But in that, what are the standards? What are the indicators for narcissism? What are the indicators for empathy?
Empathy, it's measured based on what people say about themselves. Things like, I care about people in need. I have feelings of concern for them. I can imagine other people's perspectives. So millennials are scoring lower on that. And then for narcissism, it's statements like, if I ruled the world, it would be a better place. That's my favorite one. So there's a number of them, but that's an example of the types of
hubris measures. Comes to mind.
Yes,
there,
exactly.
But how great is the variance, say, between generations when we talk about these differences in empathy and narcissism?
Since we've started to measure these scales in the late 70s and early 80s, it's about a 40% decline in empathy and I think about a 35% rise in narcissism.
Okay, so they track fairly closely.
Yes, they do.
It is. And has that been a steady thing or has it exploded over? I realize I'm taking us off point, but I'm kind of fascinated.
No, that's okay.
It's
relevant to giving, and I think we'll discuss it as it comes up. But for empathy at least, it's especially a strong effect starting at the year 2000, and we're not sure why.
Okay, so we have no idea what the cause might be or anything.
Exactly.
But it is something that is definite. And what's the impact of that, Ben?
It's hard to say exactly, but based on other research, looking at if people are saying they're empathetic or if they're narcissistic, what do they do? People who are empathetic are the ones who are more likely to volunteer, more likely to make donations. So they're the ones we need in our organizations to help others in need. They're also just generally like kind toward people they know in their everyday life, not just to organizations. And they're careful about what they say and do. They're less aggressive. And then with narcissists, it's like the opposite of that. So actually, I've done some work showing that they become aggressive if you give them sort of negative feedback. So,
if you're just joining us, we are talking about philanthropy, the changing nature of giving here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. I might add, if you are in fact a millennial or someone who is charitably inclined, this would be a good time to lend your voice to this discussion. So, Pam, you're actively in the business of going out and trying to engage with people and engage with their philanthropic impulses. Does this track with your experience with having to ask people for support on a regular basis?
Well, one way, John, that we can tell why people are giving is on our giving form currently online, you have the opportunity when you give to write a comment. That's a wonderful opportunity for us because as the on-air fundraising manager here, I unfortunately don't get to meet in person all of our donors, our members. And as much as I'd like to, sometimes the only way I can reach them is or they can reach me, is through the giving form and through these fundraising drives that we have, these membership drives on radio and in television and also digitally. But to give you an example, one of the comments that came in recently when this person gave, this was the comment, "This is a gift. The election really took a toll on my wife, and she valued WFYI's coverage. Thank you." That's how we know. And so to answer your question, John, I'm not sure that the trends that Dr. Conrath is talking about are seen per se. We hear, because people are giving to public media, whether it's because of television, radio, or what they learn online, they believe there's value in public media. I don't know, for instance, the average the donor for radio is in the 40s. Mm. The average donor here for TV, the 60s. So that younger audience, we might not be hearing from quite yet. I know they're out there, but that gives you some idea of our audience right now and our donors.
Una, that, does that track with other not-for-profit? Again, in my my years, I know that there was almost a near panic when, you know, which is why all of the not-for-profits that I sort of worked in my circle pivoted all at the same time to sort of plan giving and figuring, okay, we need to talk to these older donors until we figure out how to engage with this younger group of supporters, because it could be a long time between drinks of water here.
Absolutely. I would definitely agree that demographic shifts are one of the most important broad forces right now that are changing the nature of charitable giving. As everyone, I'm sure, on the call knows, millennials have now overtaken boomers as the largest cohort in American demographic history. What this means for nonprofits is the questions being raised, will millennials give at the same rate as their counterparts in the boomer generation or even the greatest generation? And our data right now suggests that millennials are not giving at the same rates, but there are many reasons for that. Many of them are younger in their life cycles, their incomes are lower, their wealth levels are lower, and they entered the labor market at a point, as all of you know, during the Great Recession, where the job market was not as strong and their starting salaries and incomes were quite low. Even adjusting for a lot of those factors, we still find millennials are giving at lower levels than the older generations at the same point in their life cycle. And I think this is a broad concern as nonprofits start to think about how to engage millennials. The other big insight from our research is that their motives for giving and the types of organizations they support may be different from what their counterparts in the older cohorts may have done. We're seeing that millennials are very interested in having an impact, and so they want to give to organizations that are having an impact, whether that's the environment and international. We're also seeing that they're very interested in new models of giving, social enterprises, impact investing, and they also want to support nonprofits in different ways than their parents or their grandparents. Having said that, I think the energy and the excitement that millennials can bring to an organization suggests that it's really important that nonprofits start to think about how to harness this energy and these new pathways to bring donors in. And organizations that are using some of those new approaches are actually finding a lot of success.
And I don't want to belabor the point of the, you know, this break, but has this been a trend? Because in some ways we're talking about themes to some degree of community disintegration, social isolation, the whole kind of bowling alone phenomenon that book is 30 years old, I think, something like that.
20.
20? Yeah,
yes.
I thought it was a product of the late 80s. I may have been 90s. Mistaken there. But so, and for those who don't understand, it's the argument that we no longer have as many community ties as we once did. Is this, this changing nature of philanthropy, Sarah, I'm going to throw this to you, and these accelerated numbers a product of that sense of disintegration and isolation?
I'm not sure if it's a product of it or if it's just part of that change that's it's included in it, because I think you don't get philanthropy without having good relationships with others and associating and meeting people and learning about other people's needs and learning about organizations in your community. And that's what can inspire you to want to help.
Yeah, Pam.
John, I might jump in, because something that we've started is a young professionals group for that very reason, what Sarah was saying here, that it's connecting. And in our mission statement, it's about telling stories and connecting people. And so we realize that someone out there, younger, starting a career, if that person doesn't feel connected, this organization may not feel applicable or relevant But we are starting a young professionals group. It's growing through our community engagement team, and we're seeing some results. People are showing up. They're talking about some of the radio programs and sharing the experiences. I think that is a building block, if you will.
Again, if you are just joining us, we are talking about philanthropy in honor of Giving Tuesday here on No Limits, and really about how giving has changed. My guests are Dr. Una Osili. She's professor of economics and director of research at IU's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Dr. Sarah Conrath, associate professor at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And our own Pam Elliott, who is director of on-air development for WFYI. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about philanthropy in honor of Giving Tuesday, which is today, and we're talking really about the way that giving has changed. My guests are Dr. Una Osili. She is professor of economics and director of research at IU's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Dr. Sarah Conrath. She's associate professor at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. And our own Pam Elliott, who is director of on-air development for WFYI. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Find us on social media, or you can do what a listener named Abe has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Abe writes, "We hear of research that seems conflicting. Overall donations are on the rise, yet we see a decrease in empathy among younger generations. I'm curious if Dr. Sarah Conrath believes that the general increase in narcissism that we see in the younger generation could be used in donor relations, in essence, using their self-interest as a solicitation strategy."
That's Sarah. An amazing question. Actually, we just published a paper on the topic of how do narcissistic people give, because I think it's an important question, right? We can't assume that all of our donors or all the reasons why we give are because we care and we're empathetic. I mean, we'd want to assume that maybe, but we can't. And what we found is that the reason why they give is in order to receive something. It doesn't have to be a concrete gift, although you probably notice at WFYI when you offer those little incentives. Mm-hmm. That
Oh, we do.
And that works, right?
Mm-hmm. On television especially.
Okay, so it doesn't have to be that, but it can be something like attention, right? So maybe their name is recognized or posted somewhere or mentioned on air. It could be any type of little thing that feels like they're receiving something back.
So the recognition strategy becomes much more important than with these narcissistic givers.
Yeah, I mean, we did a study on the ice bucket challenge, for example, mm-hmm. where we just examined like how did people score in narcissism based on what they did. And we found that the narcissistic people, all they did was post the video. I don't think this is surprising stuff, right? This is like what we all were thinking. But the lower narcissistic people, so the more empathetic people, are the ones who, they may have posted a video or not, but they gave. And in fact, the lowest narcissism was the people who only gave and didn't post a video.
So in terms of this, I mean, how should not-for-profits begin adjusting their communications with their donors, with their constituencies, in light of this new research? Because it used to be, obviously, you sold people on the mission and said, this is it, come be part of this. And in some ways, you were supposed to submerge yourself into a larger cause. I'm oversimplifying greatly, but that was the message for most not-for-profits or enterprises. It's saying, from what I'm hearing Sarah and to some degree Una saying right now too, is that's not the case. These folks do not want to subsume their personalities or their identities into something larger than themselves.
I can comment just to add from the data side, what we're learning is it's a much more complex world as far as fundraising and working with donors. One size doesn't fit all anymore. You have donors of all different backgrounds, diverse across age, race, gender, ethnicity, also personality and what they value. And so I think nonprofits can do a lot to better understand their donors, both their current donors and potential donors, and actually build strategy, sort of market segmentation is what I would recommend to actually adapt to this changing landscape. It used to be that one model worked for most donors. What we're learning is that approach may not be as effective in this much more complex landscape.
And what we're seeing is the PBS model, the NPR model, is being looked at seriously across the country. You know, we do get excited when we get a new tote bag or a mug to share with our listeners or our viewers. And we are seeing a shift, John, in radio givers aren't as apt to be wanting the gift in return, wanting the mug, wanting the CD. But the TV audience still, there is a large enough TV audience that is out there doing some shopping. And that is certainly not to belittle the TV audience because, I mean, my father is a perfect example. Loves the Broadway shows, wants the CDs. It's easier for him to get it through public media than to get it on Amazon or something like that. But we are looking at that, and we're trying to create, really, for members, experiences, because we really believe that public media is more than a tote bag or a CD. It's access. It's access for all. And so some of the successful campaigns we've run are about, for instance, putting some of our members on stage with the Beach Boys, because we can do that with our affiliation with the programs and the producers. We have tickets to Hamilton in Chicago that will be offered on Monday night live here at WFYI. So we understand that we want to provide access for all. That is what public media is about. It's access for all. And at different giving levels, there might be that experience that we can bring to a person's life. But we also acknowledge that, yes, and it's okay to want a WFYI tote bag. We're all for it. Take it everywhere.
But that also plays into that sort of narcissistic model, too, because it then becomes about saying, okay, this is who I am. This is, it becomes a statement of your values and all of that to the larger group. Una, I see you nodding your head. Is that?
Well, I think we're recognizing that values, donors' values really drive a lot of their giving decisions. And so for nonprofits, it's a lot more investment in understanding those donors and what that kind of relationship can be to provide the type of donor experiences. It's more customized, I think. And it sounds complicated, but I think with the help of technology, many nonprofits are figuring this out in terms of administering a survey using end user feedback, such as what has just been described.
Well, and in some ways, it sounds like to me that, you know, we're talking about where the research is and all of that. This is a pretty fundamental shift because we're talking about different motivations for giving that are generally. Yeah, Sarah now enthusiastically is nodding her head here, which gets to the core of it, right? Can you talk a little bit to that point?
Well, just that's, I mean, what I said earlier about I didn't want to stereotype millennials. I mean, you can't really tell by somebody's age what their motivations are, but you can tell if you ask them.
Yeah.
Well, and don't you think, too, a life experience? I mean, I grew up in a family where giving was, there was modeling going on. My parents were giving, and I saw them giving. And, you know, whether it's pulling from the angel tree something for kids in the community around the holidays, I think it's what you, it's almost a learning experience. And some people have never had the means, nor have they had the role model to give. I just want to read another comment, though, John, if I might, because I think it plays into what we're talking about in motivation of giving. We had a donor recently write, I grew up watching PBS on WFYI, Electric Company, Nature Nova, Masterpiece, Mystery, and I don't get TV anymore, but I still believe in the mission and do a small part to support it. Obviously, this person has a history with public media and probably is older. But again, there's a value system there that we see a lot. And it really touches all of us, because we realize that even people who don't watch or even listen regularly understand the value to the community in us being here.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the changing face and nature of philanthropy on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Patrick has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Patrick, welcome to the program.
Well, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, younger people and donating to causes, you know, which has been called millennials back and forth. Problematic term, but that's another conversation for another day. I think one thing that has to be taken into account is younger folks have access to technology and therefore more information about organizations, which I think plays into part of their decision-making when it comes to giving to charity. For example, younger people have, you know, people have gone on record and say they don't want to donate to organizations like Susan G. Komen, who have a few issues, let's say, with, you know, how much is spent for charity and versus how much goes to their executives and to legal issues. The basic point is, you know, younger people want to know their dollars are being used for what a charity says they're going to do, and that might lead to a certain degree of cheesiness for certain organizations.
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Patrick, or the comment, more to the point. Una, you're nodding your head. You made eye contact, so I'll throw that question to you.
Yes, I think I would agree with the caller. Thank you for that question. Certainly, the younger generation have been exposed to different types of influences compared to their older counterparts. They've grown up with mobile technology. They've grown up with the internet. They use the internet to find out about charitable causes. And they're more influenced by social media because they are connected to their peers and to other networks around giving. So that is something that I think is another takeaway for nonprofits in terms of how to engage the younger generation, millennials, Gen Xers, and even to some extent boomers, is the use of technology is changing and many donors are going online to learn about causes. And so nonprofits, some of them are still in that learning process to build a website that's mobile friendly, that's accessible, so that anyone can access information. I think there's also a sense in which transparency is very important. I heard the caller say that. To what extent is a nonprofit, I would say, transparent and accountable around how those donors donations are going to be used and how the reporting around impact will be done. And here, I think it's very important not just that the financials, the organization's transparent around its financial disclosure, but also around the work that it's doing and sharing as much information about the impact that it's having beyond just how organizations are spending their resources.
This is a larger question, but I'm picking up on some of what Una and Sarah and Pam's point about the giving tree and how this is learned to some degree behavior. Are we talking, I mean, is this a manifestation of perhaps at least some fraying of the idea of a social contract, the idea that we owe something to each other, because that's part of the charitable impulse? And I know, at least in talking to a lot of the younger people, they don't necessarily have the faith that if they work hard, follow the rules, that there necessarily will be a place or a role for them, which is not a doubt that many earlier generations would express, at least not as openly as they do. Sarah, I'm going to throw that one to you.
I can just say that I don't know of any data on this, but I do empathize with younger generations in the sense that it used to be that, you know, you get a college degree, you get a job, you're going to stay in that job for a while, you'll retire and have a nice pension. That's the old model. And right now it's so financially insecure for young people. And you know, without a graduate degree, they struggle. Even with a graduate degree, there's challenges, and it takes a long time to get settled and experience, you know, traditional trappings of adult life, like being married and having children, because that's expensive and difficult to get to.
And I probably, not to interrupt you, but I should emphasize, I'm not offering that as criticism, more as an observation, because
yes.
I have some empathy, too. I understand where the insecurity could come from.
It's different for them. I mean, many of them are now living with their parents, and I don't think when they were younger that was what they imagined they'd be doing in their early 30s or whatever. There's a huge amount of people at that age group now still living with their parents, and probably for good reason, and hopefully those situations are working well, but I don't think that is what they were hoping for.
We hear, more often than you might think, people saying to us, well, I just don't have enough to give.
Yeah.
And in their minds, people, I think, place a dollar value on a significant gift. And we try never to do that here. And the reason being, because again, as public media, we feel that WFYI should represent the whole. And that means the individual is what matters. And so whether the gift is $5 a month or $500, we want people to feel they're a part of something bigger. They are a part of public media in central Indiana. The other thing I would like to comment on, John, and with you all and Sarah and Una, that there's a trust factor that goes into this. And that's why sustaining membership is something that we see growing, because even when you become a sustainer here at WFYI at a certain level, whether it's $10 a month or $15 or what have you, you are the controller of that. There's no signed contract. Mm-hmm. It's a trust thing. So the next couple months, you lose your job. You call us, you say, I'm not in a position any longer to continue my membership, or I just got a promotion. I'd like to up my monthly gift. That we can do for you. And that, I think, is embracing the changing times. We don't expect somebody today to know what 5 years down the road the giving picture will be.
We're talking about the changing face of philanthropy here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what Derek has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Derek, welcome to the program.
Quick comment. I know that it seems that charitable organizations are going to have to take a very hard look on how they're expecting donations from the younger generation, particularly college graduates who will go on earning significant amounts of money. When it comes to those college graduates being put on excessive amounts of student debt before anyone going through college, or most people going through college, begin to have any income that they could donate, they're having to deal with debt payments from $200 to over $1,000 a month. I wanted to see what the commenters had to say about those specific issues or things that they're dealing with. I don't believe that the millennial generation is more narcissistic than, say, the older generations, but I believe we do have specific challenges that inhibit us from donating as much as I believe most of us would like to.
Thanks very much for the call and the observation, Derek. I'll throw that one. Una and Sarah, I'd like to hear both your thoughts.
I think the caller raises a very important point, which we addressed maybe a bit earlier, that we do understand from our data that millennials are particularly unique. They entered the labor market in a very volatile economic period. They experienced much weaker labor market recovery than other generations have. And many of them, as Sarah said, have struggled to attain the same level of financial and economic security that their parents experienced. And so I think it's with all of those factors in mind that we definitely qualify that anyone can give at any level. That was really a very important point out of the data, that to be a giver, you don't need to have huge sums of money, that you can make contributions. It doesn't have to be time. It doesn't have to be money. It can be time as well.
Sarah,
I was going to say the same, that I hear the caller saying, well, I don't even have money because I have debt to deal with, and that's, I can't give stuff I don't have. But everybody has a little bit of time, or even just their voice. They can promote the charities they care about through their friends on social media. So there's many other ways to get involved philanthropically, and you don't always have to do it with money.
We are talking about the changing nature of philanthropy here on No Limits in honor of Giving Tuesday, which is today. My guests are Dr. Una Osili and Dr. Sarah Conrath. They're both of IU's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy and WFYI's own Pam Elliott. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can find us on social media or send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about how giving has changed, the changing nature of philanthropy in honor of Giving Tuesday, which is today. My guests are Dr. Una Osili. She is professor of economics and director of research at IU's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Dr. Sarah Conrath, who is associate professor at the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy, and Pam Elliott of our own WFYI. She's director of on-air development. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Katie has done and reach out to us via Facebook. You can find us at No Limits WFYI. Katie writes, I'm fascinated by the decline in empathy and increase in narcissism mentioned. As a millennial, I am curious if one of the guests might offer any thoughts on how we can foster an environment where empathy can grow. Sarah and Una are pointing at each other right now. I think you lost, Sarah. You get the question.
Right. Well, I think it's about, it sounds like maybe that's important to the listener.
Yes.
Empathy is important to her. One way to start developing it is just to talk about it and treat it like it's important that it is a value. And I think part of this show is about that. We're promoting not only giving, but sort of the reasons why people give. And there's many different ways we can do that in research. There's lots and lots of studies on it. But we're doing some fun work in our lab right now, designing mobile-based interventions to increase empathy in young people. So text messages and actually an app. We just released an app in which people can play games that practice certain skills that are related to empathy, like reading others' emotions and helping people do little things they need.
We have a T-shirt that reads Kind Indiana. And it was part of a series that we were doing in our newsroom and putting on the air here on WFYI 90.1 radio. And I have to tell you, during the election, it became quite the popular T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it you don't even have to speak it. You can wear it. You can use it in social media. We had a hashtag, LoveWFYI, encouraging people to talk about their favorite programs. I think, again, our mission is to share stories and connect people. And people love our programs. And why? Because they inspire them to do good things. They give you something to think about that is encouraging and hopeful. And people are looking for that. I don't think we can underestimate the strength or the power of a story that leaves you hopeful and inspired.
Gotten an email from a listener named Kayla, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Kayla writes, according to the report Women Give that also comes from the School of Philanthropy, millennial and Gen X women are more generous than other generations when they were of that age, but there is still a decline of empathy of that generation. Why? Sarah, I feel like you are the you're the one who's catching all the tough ones, too.
I wish I knew the answer.
I could say that where we have not seen declines in giving would be among women. Millennial women seem to be holding up the giving sky, as it were. Our recent Women Give report, the listener notes that there are gender differences in giving that the school has uncovered, researchers at the school. And in our Women Give report, the group that has held up the giving levels are the single millennial women, as well as millennial couples, millennial and Gen X couples, where women are very involved in charitable giving decisions. So this suggests that there are places where we are seeing some differences, especially among gender women, essentially. And then I would also note that parents can have a role to play in shaping the next generation. So for the caller, if you're interested in how do we build empathy, we can also think about how can we raise charitable children. And what we've learned through our research is that talking about giving is actually more effective than role modeling in terms of raising charitable children, which is a bit of a surprise. People think it's how you model giving, but it's also important that parents talk about giving, why they give, why giving is important. So we have a bit of a call to action as part of our show today. If you are involved with, if you're a parent or involved with young children, talk about why you give, share that message. That can be just as, actually even more powerful than the role modeling that probably you're already doing.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about the changing face of philanthropy here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what Eric has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Eric, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, John. I always appreciate listening. My question is for the guests, and I wondered about a correlation coefficient in any of the research that would suggest folks who do not donate monetary time show an increase in their volunteer time. For example, I'm one of the millennial pack on program today. I don't necessarily have a lot of money, but I found that, you know, my volunteer time seems to make up for what money gives, and I was wondering if there was any research that could be pinned to.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Yeah, great question. In general, we do find that giving and volunteering tend to go hand in hand. They're very highly correlated. But we also see, especially for different groups of people, and young people could be part of that demographic, where some people are giving a lot of time, but not necessarily money. So I think you certainly fall into that group, and it fits into this larger picture that philanthropy is more than just money. It's also about giving time, giving of yourself, giving of your talents.
We've gotten a tweet from a listener named Nathan, and again, if you want to track us down on Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Nathan writes, Sarah, Una, have you seen long-term studies on the best ways institutions for teaching compassion leading to increased giving? Are there some best practices that are out there now that people who are actually ahead of this wave, as it were? Start with Una and then go to Sarah.
I think the research on parents' practices, parenting practices, has been very powerful for me as a parent. In our study, it's a longitudinal study of American families, and it also looks at children in those families. And we found that parents who talk about giving actually have a much more of an impact on their children than just role modeling alone. And so that, I think, is a message that we can actually take forward. It's important for us to talk about it, not just do it, especially where it relates to cultivating empathy, cultivating giving, and generosity, I think, across all segments of society.
We're talking about the changing nature of giving here on No Limits. Leslie, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just noting that as a millennial, it seems to me that even though we don't have a lot of money, we do still give a lot. I think that it's just changed in how we give. A lot of us have, you know, end up having, you know, large medical bills or things like that. And so someone sets up a GoFundMe and people give $5 or $10 to that. And so, you know, it's less of philanthropy to organizations who do still need it and deserve it. But it is, I would say, kind of a direct philanthropy, you know, kind of like bringing the casserole to someone when they're, you know, they don't have as much food in their house, but it's like monetarily online. Is there any thought on that, or is there any information that correlates that?
Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Leslie. Una, I'll throw that one to you, but I want to hear Sarah's thoughts, too.
Yes, we are seeing a shift in how donors are giving. I'm glad the caller raised that point. In particular, giving directly has gained a lot of attention recently. GoFundMe, in terms of dollars raised on that platform, is almost as large as the Gates Foundation by size. So I think it's something we're
Sarah's
starting to study.
Sarah's mouth just dropped on that.
So as a platform, it's really fascinating. I think to buttress the listener's question. Last year, many of you may recall, Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan set up a new initiative, the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, to support, basically fight inequality around the globe. But they didn't set up a family foundation, which is what was done in the past. They set up an LLC to allow them to not just support nonprofits, but also to invest in social enterprises and businesses and to advocate around causes that they care about, especially around health and education. So I think that is a really important point. Now, there are some challenges with the giving directly movement, as it were, because those are not gifts to a 501c3. And so whether it's charitable or not may be more difficult for us as data people to discern. For example, people can use GoFundMe to raise money for their vacations abroad or to buy new furniture for their house. So as a data person, it would be quite difficult for the researchers to discern what segment of GoFundMe is helping a person in need or even helping somebody who's less fortunate. Some of those gifts could actually be helping the individual. And while those are all important in terms of generosity, it's quite difficult to actually capture the size of that GoFundMe crowdfunding platform market that's directly linked to charity.
And we probably ought to emphasize, there are probably people out there who don't know what 501c3 means. That means that your gift is tax deductible,
right,
which sets up the question, have we seen with this rise of the GoFundMe movement, because a lot of it skips over not-for-profits altogether, goes straight to individuals or to other human beings, and in the process also means that you skip the tax deduction because most human beings aren't set up as 501c3s. They don't go through that hoop, although many of them clearly now are not-for-profit. But are we seeing that this is a trend, that they want that sense of personal connection rather than an institutional one? Sarah, I'll throw that to you.
I'm not sure if that's a trend, but I did hear in the comment from the listener that that the giving is becoming more individualistic or at least smaller scale than and less organizational. So it reminded me of what we were talking about earlier with Bowling Alone. And the point of that book is just the change in our participation in broader organizations in our communities and in our country. So I don't know that I don't want to say if it's good or bad or whatever, but it does seem like there's something about the millennials. There's something I'd love to understand why. So what is it about nonprofit organizations or organized religion? It's all these other organized types of things that doesn't really resonate very well with millennials for some reason.
Well, and I guess what I'm wondering also, and I'm asking this question really out of ignorance and curiosity purely, you know, if I give $5 to the Gates Foundation, you know, there's no real impact. If I give $5 to somebody I know on the street, I know that there's likely to be a larger proportional impact. And if you have relatively few dollars to give, is this to some degree a question of scale, that they want to know that whatever they give is going to have some impact? Una?
Yeah, I think crowdfunding combines several factors. There's certainly this idea that you have a direct relationship with the recipient, but there's also the interaction of technology, the fact that you can see how that goal is being met and that you're getting almost daily, sometimes throughout the day, reports on how that campaign is going. So that connectivity with the donor, I think, is something that's quite interesting. And then added to that is this issue of trust in institutions and versus trust in individuals kind of competing. And I think that some charities are starting to learn from this Give Directly movement, where you connect the donor with a particular individual that they want to help. For example, Heifer International, World Vision connects you with a child that you can change their life. So I think now, because of these changes that we have witnessed, there are opportunities for nonprofits to begin to innovate within this space. And some nonprofits are using crowdfunding actually to raise large sums of money for particular causes and using that same excitement and interactivity that comes out of a campaign that's on social media, where donors are getting daily updates or even, I would say, hourly updates on how the fundraising is going.
Barbara, welcome to the program.
Yes, I am a boomer with a millennial daughter. We are both active here in town. Mm-hmm. I I believe that the changes that you've been talking about with millennial givers is really just a continuation of the trend. My boomer generation is certainly a lot different from our parents, but I like your experts' comments on, I think, the trend towards philanthropists demanding more efficiency, both in terms of the time they're expected to give. We certainly don't join these auxiliaries like our grandmothers did. And also the desire to kind of be our own program officers. I see a big trend in giving circles.
Thanks very much for the call and the question. Una.
Yes, we are seeing a rise in donor, I would say, expectations. Donors are certainly expecting that the nonprofits they support will use those donations efficiently, will be transparent, will be good stewards of those resources. And when they volunteer, we're also seeing that some potential volunteers want more formal training and orientation. So they want their time to be well spent, too. So we're seeing a much more competitive nonprofit marketplace. So I do agree with the points that the listener has raised.
So if you were advising, I'm going to throw this out there, the three of you. If you were advising based on your varied experiences, not-for-profits or worthwhile enterprises, try to connect with these new donors with new expectations, new motivations, it sounds like. How would you suggest they do it? I'll start with Pam first.
Well, John, I don't want to oversimplify, but I really believe the passion leads to the giving. So to me, what are you passionate about? And think about what during the day is important to you. And, you know, we talk to our listeners and viewers that way. If WFYI is important to you, you know, maybe it's time to consider giving. And then we also feel it's a responsibility on our part to give our members, our donors, opportunities to gather and share common interests. So if the program, the radio program, is of interest to you, there's a particular program, and then we want to gather you. We are trying to open up our doors even more. I mean, obviously, in this day and age, you have to always be careful, but we are public media. And so we have initiated public parties, gatherings, if you will, to discuss things that maybe it's a Ken Burns documentary or maybe even better, our own local documentaries. We've had some incredible ones recently on our bicentennial, of course, Hoosiers. And we've also had the Crispus Attucks, the school that opened a city. And that brought people together of people who might not have been together otherwise. So I think you need to give opportunities for people to gather and talk about the programs.
I'm going to give Una about 20 seconds, and then Sarah gets to wrap up.
I would just say that we're living in disruptive times, disruption in terms of technology, economic change, and demographic change. And for nonprofits to embrace some of this change and understand it and design strategies to basically build relationships with these new donors as well as existing donors. And so it's an exciting time, but there's certainly challenges. But I think that using some of these new approaches can be extremely effective.
And I'll tell you, I think probably that's going to have to be the last word. Sarah, this just means we're going to have everybody back to continue the conversation another time. I'd like to thank my guests, Una Osili, Sarah Conrath, and Pam Elliott. Like to thank our listeners for some great questions. Invite everybody back on Thursday when we're going to be talking about closing the skills gap in Indiana. I'm John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cerzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.